Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about what's next for the Green Party, Trump's choice of Ben Carson as the Secretary of the Housing and Urban Development piece of the government. But before we can move on, in a fairly surprising turn of events, the Army Corps of Engineers is denying approval for a section of the Dakota Access Pipeline to cross under a lake in North Dakota, which at least for now will stop the project. Water protectors in the camps were jubilant at the announcement, which clearly would never have taken place without the struggle that they waged. That must be point number one of the takeaway from this fight. This victory didn't come from politicians. It came from a grassroots uprising against the Dakota Access Pipeline led by the Standing Rock Sioux. By melding the concerns for tribal sovereignty with traditional Native American beliefs about the importance of sustainability, a massive coalition of people rallied around a struggle that embodied not only the struggle for survival on the planet, but also raised issues of planetary sustainability that spoke to the kind of unity and recognition of the struggle of oppressed peoples that's required for us to live together in a sustainable fashion. First, the Keystone XL pipeline. Now this, it seems safe to say the lesson we can draw is that mass nonviolent civil disobedience combined with strong solidarity campaigns can make a difference. Beyond that, we can say that in general, the fact is that resistance is possible and it isn't futile. While I generally live by the maxim of Emiliano Zapata that I'd rather die on my feet than live on my knees, it's worth remembering that just because you stand up for what you believe, it's not preordained that you'll lose. The second lesson should be this, that this is another reminder that in the eyes of the government, what comes first are the rights of property, not people. The actions of police and the National Guard were out of all proportion with what was taking place. The Morton County Sheriff's Department turned themselves essentially into a private security force for energy transfer partners and their Wall Street investors. They went far beyond policing the interactions between companies, security, and water protectors to actively suppressing peaceful protests on behalf of the company. Third, and perhaps most important overall, is we have to remain vigilant because this very easily could be a temporary victory. Energy Transfer Partners says they remain committed to finishing the project, and incoming President Donald Trump, who actually has somewhere probably between 500,000 and 2 million invested in the pipeline himself, has said he wants it to continue. The issue at stake is the Army Corps of Engineers' decision to not allow an easement under a lake. Of course, once Trump is president, he can pressure, order, cajole, whatever, the people in the Army Corps of Engineers to allow it to go through. He could also, if he chose, try to negotiate a deal to reroute the pipeline, which is essentially what the Obama administration is proposing. The hope being, if they can solve the issue of it being on tribal land, they can take the wind out of the sails of the anti-pipeline movement. So now, it is as important as it has ever been that the struggle against fracking, pipelines, oil trains, coal exports, and all other forms of planet and humanity-killing businesses deepen and expand. Not, metaphorically speaking, pack up the tents and head home. Trump is saying that he is going to increase growth by 4%. Primarily through a big tax cut that allegedly is going to stimulate the economy combined with a tax holiday for repatriated corporate profits now being held overseas, as well as, of course, his alleged infrastructure plan. All that, of course, sounds very good, except for the fact that it also happens to be totally untrue. J.P. Morgan, venerable Wall Street bank, took a look at Trump's tax proposals. They estimated that between business and personal taxes, Trump will cut about $200 billion per year in taxes. They estimate that the boost to GDP from these cuts will be 0.6% for personal taxes and 0.4% for business taxes. So essentially for every dollar in tax cuts, there'll be between 40 and 60 cents of a potential boost there economically. Although ultimately what that means is that it will do almost nothing to boost economic growth above where it is right now and certainly won't get close to the 4% goal. The other big boon that the Trump people are saying is coming is from a corporate tax holiday. Now, there are two pieces to this. One, the money repatriated will not be used to invest in production or jobs, but instead to enrich companies and their shareholders. And in fact, during the Bush administration, they did something like this. They had one of these tax holidays. They passed a bill in Congress. It even included a provision that the money must be used to invest in jobs, not stock buybacks and all that. However, the new law came in, the money gets brought back at a super low tax rate, and businesses actually used it to buy back stock and pay out dividends. Currently, there is about $2.6 trillion allegedly being held by U.S. corporations overseas for tax purposes. The top five in order of overseas cash holdings as of September 30th of this year are Apple, $216 billion, Microsoft, $111 billion, Cisco Systems, $60 billion, Oracle Corp, $51 billion, and Apple Alphabet Inc., which used to be Google, $48 billion. Wow. Silicon Valley there. Someone asked the CEO of Cisco Systems, Chuck Robbins, what he would do with this money if they could bring it back at an ultra-low tax rate that could be as low as 5%. His response was, quote, "We do have various scenarios in terms of what we do, but you can assume we'll focus on the obvious ones, buybacks, dividends, and merger and acquisition activities," end quote. So there you have it. The company with the third most money stashed overseas is saying that they will not use the money to boost job growth. Goldman Sachs, in fact, estimates that 20% of corporate stock buybacks in the next several years will be driven by repatriated profits. There is, however, one more issue with the tax thing. It actually isn't $2.6 trillion. Only about $1 trillion is in cash. The other roughly $1.5 trillion has been reinvested by those companies in their operations overseas and is not available to even be repatriated. So on two different levels here, you have a clear sign that Trump's tax cuts will not boost economic growth, which isn't really surprising, given that the link between tax cuts and growth is highly contingent on a range of other issues. And overall, the whole theory of trickle-down economics has been proven time and again to be faulty. Oh, right. And for that infrastructure plan, well, I'll let economist Paul Krugman explain what a boondoggle that really is. He says, quote, "Imagine a private consortium building a toll road for $1 billion. Under the Trump plan, the consortium might borrow $800 million while putting up $200 million in equity. But it would get a tax credit of 82% of that sum, so its actual outlays would only be $36 million. And any future revenue from tolls would go to the people who put up that $36 million. We've just, in effect, privatized a public asset and given the buyers 82% of the purchase price in the form of a tax credit." So yeah, Trump isn't going to boost economic growth with the policies he's proposing. Sorry, Rust Belt voters. And Donald Trump has also said that wages are too high, which is supremely ironic given that he is also advocating quote-unquote middle-class tax cuts to put more money in people's pockets. However, if their wages were too high, why would they need more money? Either way, just like trickle-down, fake tax holidays, and eliminating regulations or pro-corporate sham economics, Donald Trump and Mike Pence's position on wages is also absurd and based on zero facts. A new analysis from the President's Council of Economic Advisers surveyed the 18 states and D.C., which should also be a state that recently raised the minimum wage. They found that wages are 6.6% higher for the lowest income workers and that this took place without any negative effects like job losses or negative economic growth, i.e., as advocates for the minimum wage have consistently pointed out, increasing the minimum wage is good for the economy. Interestingly enough, in San Francisco and San Jose, the restaurant industry actually grew faster after the minimum wage increased. SeaTac Washington, the first city to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, was predicted to become an economic wasteland. Instead, even some of the business owners who opposed the wage increase are now expanding their businesses in the wake of a higher minimum wage. In Seattle, right next to SeaTac, where the $15 an hour minimum wage is being phased in, the unemployment is at an 8-year low. Two-thirds of all small business owners in New York State said they supported the right of cities to raise their minimum wage unilaterally inside of the state because in many places, higher wages are the only way to help keep the cities from slipping into intense income inequality. Either way, no matter how you slice it, the minimum wage is not bad for the economy, and outside of one or two studies done by the same people who always do these pro-business studies, there is literally no real evidence that you can go wrong by giving people more of what they need to survive in capitalist America. And those were today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
by any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be continuing our conversation, talking a little bit about some recount stuff, some Green Party and third party politics, and what that portends for the progressive movement overall, by Mr. Ben Mansky, who's an advocate, scholar, lawyer, and public speaker. Ben, thanks for joining the show.
Happy to be here with you today.
So I'm going to jump right into the topic du jour as it concerns the green movement, if you will. Some people might not say it, like it if I said Green Party, but that's this issue of the recount that Jill Stein's campaign has been spearheading in Wisconsin and in Michigan and at one point Pennsylvania, which has now dropped it. Lots of controversy here. So I'll start with this question. Why Jill Stein? Why not let Clinton do this herself in these states where the only, you know, possible separate result would be her winning? I mean, why do these few states, when in some ways that perhaps feeds into, you know, some of the Clintonian narrative, as some would say?
Well, to be clear, first of all, my understanding is that the Stein campaign has not dropped Pennsylvania. Instead, they've switched gears and they have filed in federal court. So that was really just a switch in venue. Mm. So all three states are still very much in play. And the short answer as to why the Greens have to stand up for voting rights and election integrity is because the Democrats simply don't and won't. And that's been the history of politics in our lifetimes, is that the Democratic and Republican parties both are run by a permanent class of political operators who are here day in and day out in between elections. They don't pay the consequences for what happens with elections for the most part. I mean, there's just a revolving door between lobbying groups, business, and non-governmental organizations and government for both of the establishment parties. And so what that has meant, certainly since the Florida 2000 stolen election and also Ohio 2004 and in other elections since, is that, you know, voting rights have not been on the agenda of the Democratic and Republican parties as parties. There are some exceptions there. But overall, you know, Hillary Clinton was not going to fight for the right to vote before this election or after it, because she has a future. She's got her hundreds of millions. She has her book deals. She still has a life ahead of her. And, you know, we voters, we the public, only really matter to the Democrats when they want our vote. And once the election is passed, they tend to be done with it. So it has fallen to the Greens and to social movements to fight for the right to vote over the last 15 to 20 years in particular. And that's what Jill Stein is doing in this case, in these three states in which there were compelling reasons for her to intervene.
Well, I think that's a good question, because the other point that I've seen some people raise in opposition to this is like, well, New Hampshire, allegedly, I haven't looked that deep into it. Allegedly, there were some questions. That was a state that was won by Clinton. Texas, where potentially a Green Party candidate could have maybe gotten enough votes if the recount somehow ended up finding these votes that were not properly counted to gain ballot status. So, I mean, do you view this as more of just an issue of feasibility over the three states they went with, or is there something else there, which I think is more or less what people are alleging?
Yeah, which a small number of people are alleging for reasons that are kind of disparate and don't seem to have any kind of political principle behind them. And in most cases, there are some exceptions to that. But in terms of the noisy opposition to this from a few folks, there's not really any consistency there that I can see. I mean, the reality, I think, is what you just raised. It comes down to feasibility. The Green Party is not in a position to contest the reported totals in every state. And the Greens actually do have an interest to see that we have a hand count in every state, because, you know, the Greens do need to qualify for the ballot. We have standards in which, you know, 1% or 2% or 5%, depending on the state, will matter in terms of being able to secure ballot status in future elections. And so it comes down to questions that have to do with, one, what is the state of the law in that state? What does it take to do a recount? Two, what do we know about voting systems in that state? Three, what is the feasibility in terms of volunteers and raising money for these efforts in various states? There has been a long history of struggles around voting rights in some of these states, in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, you know, certainly in Ohio over the years. I know they were looking at Ohio at one point, and I assumed that they just had to make a decision about where they thought they could have the greatest impact in terms of exposing the way in which elections are run and the way in which so many votes in this country are never counted unless there is a recount.
Yeah, you know, I think that's it's definitely an interesting issue, and it's an important issue. And I want to sort of connect it to another point, too, which is this issue of voter suppression. I mean, to some degree, I don't think the two things are really mutually exclusive. But to be fair, some people are saying, well, you know, the bigger issue wasn't that the votes, you know, voting machines are potentially hacked, but that potentially there was voter suppression. But there's no like recount for voter suppression. You know what I mean? So I don't know how those two things work together. But nevertheless, you were in Wisconsin, which was a state where there is a lot happening in terms of voter suppression. We're going to have to take a break in about a minute, but short answer here, and we'll come right back to this. How big of an issue was voter suppression in Wisconsin in this election?
Oh, voter suppression was huge, as you know. I mean, you had me on to talk about it in the months leading up to the election. Jill Stein was very outspoken on this. So these are not mutually exclusive. We were fighting against voter suppression then. We're fighting against it now. And there is this broader voting rights movement that's fighting for a recount in these states and to fight for both voting rights and election integrity in the United States. This is all different pieces of the same puzzle.
Yeah, well, no, I think that is a great point. And as I said, we are going to go to a break here, but we're going to be back with Ben Mansky talking a lot more about voting rights, voter integrity, things happening with progressive politics, things happening with green politics, and what our movements, social movements, can perhaps learn from some of these campaigns and vice versa. But again, you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C., and I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversation about green politics, progressive politics, elections, recounts, voting rights, all that good stuff. And hopefully we'll get into a little bit more about combating right-wing populism that's popping up all over the world. But most importantly, we are joined for this conversation by Ben Mansky, who's an advocate, scholar, lawyer, and public speaker. And Ben, thanks for so much for sticking with us. And I wanted to just jump right into the next piece. We left off talking a little bit about voting rights, and I wanted to just ask, I mean, how, in some ways, I mean, it seems like this is sort of a meta issue here beyond all sort of the arguing around this recount that I don't want to lose, which is that we're really in a situation with this country where we really need a new voting rights movement. I mean, as crazy as it sounds, the right to vote, perhaps more than it's ever been, isn't sort of a given in the way that I think in the post-civil rights era, a lot of people thought it was.
It's absolutely not a given, and it's something that we do have to fight for. And I think, you know, there has been important work that has been done since the 2000 struggle over the Florida recount that has produced some positive results for voting rights and for more democratic elections in the United States. But there have been also a whole series of attacks on the right to vote that have, for example, resulted in the recent Supreme Court decision, essentially gutting the Voting Rights Act 1964. And so this is one of the pivotal struggles of this time. It's a struggle for the right to vote. It's also a struggle for democracy. I mean, let's be clear. There are sort of two levels at which the struggle for democracy in the United States is occurring right now. One of those is within representative government itself. We have this guarantee in the Constitution of a Republican form of government. That's essentially what we mean by for and by the people. But we don't have a constitutional right to vote, and we don't have confidence that our votes are counted and that the people who are elected take office having received a mandate from the voters. And so that's a really serious problem. If you have a promise of Republican government, of representative democracy, and yet, you know, even elites in this country, I mean, I would count myself among them because I'm standing here in a university right now, we don't have confidence that our votes are being counted, never mind the vast majority of Americans, then that's a very serious problem. Beyond that, there is also a movement for democracy in other sectors of society. We shouldn't ever confuse representative government with genuine democracy. And it's very important that people are not relying on the government in Washington, D.C., or state governments, or on the institution of elections alone, that there's a fight to expand democratic power in the economy, in the media, in education, and other sectors of society. So the voting rights movement is critical, and it's part of a larger struggle.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and in some ways, I mean, I think what you just said, I think to some degree speaks to a lot of what, you know, those of us who study Dr. King was sort of pointing out towards the end of his life, not sort of, definitely, which was, you know, it wasn't a step away from the struggle he was pushing for the vote to start talking about the war, to start talking about the economy and the need to really shift towards what he called a more democratic socialist mind frame, but really just sort of an expansion of democratic rights and what it really means to have, quote unquote, rule by the people into kind of all forms of society. And that was something that, you know, was obviously tragically cut short in some ways at the end of his life, although, of course, many people have been working for similar goals. But, I mean, is this perhaps, and I think looking at the Standing Rock situation, which I think you can argue is a struggle for democracy, I mean, is this the moment where perhaps that sort of late dream of King really is coming alive?
I think it is. I think that this is a moment in which there is a broad recognition in many different parts of our country that we need to struggle for popular power, for democratic power in all parts of our lives, and that we cannot rely on those who hold, you know, official office to do the right thing, to make the right decisions for us. We have to go and put ourselves on the line. We have to do the organizing. We have to bring our communities together. That's what you've seen at Standing Rock. That's popular power. That's different communities coming together, all the different tribal communities across North America and the Americas standing together, people coming from rural areas and urban areas, veterans coming out this week in the thousands to support the fight against the Axis pipeline. And I think that struggle is, there's no question, actually, just I know personally that struggle is directly tied to what's happening with the recounts, is directly tied to Black Lives Matter and the movement for Black Lives, is directly tied to the Million Student March and the struggles on college campuses for more democratic universities and colleges that are accessible to working people and run in our interests. So all these things are of a piece, and I think that most of the people who are participating fully understand that today. And so losing your illusions can be a powerful experience.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point. And I mean, it just makes me wonder if, you know, part of this is also maybe generational. I mean, I don't want to say fully generational, but if it opens up more space too for a third party as well. I mean, I was just so struck. I mean, people, even though, of course, millennials voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton, so to blame them for the loss is crazy, but be that as it may, you know, younger people vote in usually the lowest percentages. But then I think about it a little deeper. And, you know, the whole way the Clinton campaign was trying to woo millennials, particularly millennials of color, was essentially like rappers. And then there's that bizarre period where they sent Al Gore to Florida to rally millennials. I don't know what that's about, you know, but it just seems like they're so out of touch that to some degree it seems generational to me when all these social movements being pushed by young people are really, you know, shaking up the world. And the way you try to reach these people is just the height of pandering from the Democrats.
Yeah, it's symbolic politics. It's not even very good symbolic politics because they don't even speak the same language in many cases anymore. And this is somewhat generational. I mean, I'd say it's multiple generations. You know, I think pretty much anybody who came up from 1990 on has in this country, or not anybody, but the vast majority of us share some of the same experiences in terms of dealing with the same labor markets, dealing with same issues in terms of access to education or lack of it, dealing with issues of personal debt. And those issues cut across all kinds of communities, all kinds of boundaries and borders, and they do affect entire sets of people who are born around the same time. So it's millennials. It's you know, what used to be called Generation Y. It's about half of Generation X. We've been in this together. And all of that is a function, I think many people understand, of the transformation of the global economy that really took off under Bill Clinton in the 1990s and has impacted so many of us in terms of, you know, the not only the transformation of the global economy, but the transformation of the institutions in which we live, the universities, the colleges, the workplaces, the prisons, you know, the community institutions And so that, I think, is having a political effect. Mm-hmm. Folks are recognizing we have common cause, and that that cause is about dealing with the problem of capitalism and of global corporations running our economy, running our society, running our politics, and their interests, and not in ours. And so that's why I think you see all these movements that, you know, to outsiders, to, you know, the Clinton campaign and to others may seem disparate, but from within, the connections are clear.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think it's a great point. And, you know, the other thing I was thinking about is somewhat related to this, especially in, you know, as we emerge into this era of Trump, is I almost feel like we underplay the level of success that social movements are starting to have. I mean, you had the Dakota Access Pipeline piece, which, of course, made me think about Keystone XL, which is a little bit ago but still relevant. Also, the TPP killed this year. I mean, the movement for Black Lives, I mean, obviously, there's still so many issues with policing, but, I mean, really changed the whole conversation and reinserted the struggle against racism into the political conversation in a huge way. I mean, I would say, I mean, there's a lot of despair around Trump, but to some degree, I would say I'm somewhat hopeful because the social movements, I mean, whatever the Democrats are doing, it is what it is, seem to be stronger than they've been in some time, and with leadership coming from, you know, really all sectors and communities in the population. I mean, it really isn't just like a single issue, narrow uprising, but all these different struggles, and they're starting to cross-pollinate.
That's right. That's right. I think that is that feeling of both despair but also hope, despair about the state, despair about the government, despair about what the government might do to us and what it is already doing to many people around the country, but that it expands, right? But also, I think there is a sense of possibility right now. And I think that it's the job of anyone who, you know, sees themselves as being engaged in making history and trying to move our society in a better direction to take hold of that sense of hope, to point to the victories, to show the ways in which the movements not only are coming together, but have been together, and to, you know, develop an agenda for systemic change in the United States that is not so focused on federal politics and federal elections, but really is about transforming the economy, transforming our culture, transforming our society from below, as so many have been doing. So that's, I think we got to keep on doing more of what's been working. And there is a lot that has been working.
You know, and I think that is a very relevant point, because I think especially when we talk about how progressive movements are intersecting with the general sort of electoral arena, as it be. I mean, I think what a lot of people want is to see the people who are elevated saying they support certain causes to kind of take that social movement attitude into the parliament, if you will. But I wonder, you know, what. Where's the candidate pipeline? Where's the candidate development? Do we need it? I mean, so many of these progressive candidate trainings that I see people engaging with, I mean, it seems like, you know, whether it's implicit or explicit, they're only really interested in helping people run as Democrats at the end of the day. And some of them, and I'll allow them to slide, I won't name their names right now, I mean, sort of explicitly discourage people from trying to, like, activate people who don't vote and so on and so forth. So obviously the type of goals that I think people who want more sort of social movement-esque candidates have to be totally different. I mean, do we need sort of our own version of, well, I guess I am going to name a name now, Roots Camp or whatever, or is it maybe just one of those things where people emerging organically from movements, like it's just going to work and congeal one way or another?
Well, I think it does have to be deliberate, and I think you're right to gently bring our conversation down to earth again and recognize that there are some fundamental problems that our movements are facing, and one is, you know, the role of big money in steering the priorities of social movement actors. And so if there's funding and there's career tracks for younger activists that are tied to the Democratic Party, that definitely has an influence, and it does limit the independence of social movements a great deal. On the other hand, I think that you're right that there are alternatives in terms of building campaign schools and building sort of a whole cohort of new elected officials who are not tied to the establishment parties, not part of the Democratic and Republican parties. And in fact, the Green Party, after the 2012 election, we did organize campaign schools around the country. And there are Greens in office today who decided to run when they went to one of those campaign schools. So, for example, Jose Lara down the road from me in Los Angeles, school board member, decided to become attracted to the Greens through the Jill Stein campaign in 2012, went to the campaign school, decided to run for office, won elections, and is making a big difference in Los Angeles and as part of, you know, national movements as well around fighting privatization and for also for a curriculum that's meaningful to Chicano students and so on. So, you know, there are many examples of that, of people who came out of the Green Party campaign schools in 2012, 2013. My understanding is that there'll be a new round of those in the spring of campaign schools with, you know, very disciplined curriculum that are useful. You know, these are not going to be totally organic, but actually, you know, a process that comes from, you know, thought and experience of running elections and succeeding and getting independent progressive candidates into office. And I expect that process in terms of those campaign schools will be greatly expanded from last time around because, to be frank, you know, the Greens tripled in size since the last election, just as we had in the previous cycle from the previous election. So that's positive.
I think it is positive, and I think it speaks to something else. I mean, you know, how much is if, you know, people are saying we need to build a quote-unquote third force or fourth force, whatever it may be, you know, I say the more viable political party is probably the better for the discourse. But that being said, I mean, how much of this is sort of an incremental thing? I mean, the just sheer raw number of votes, as you just referenced, on the presidential level, the difference in what Jill Stein got in 2012 and now – pretty big difference, small percentage, but I mean, to what degree is it really about sort of that incremental, like, let's, you know, build step by step, place by place?
Yeah, I think maybe another word to use would be cumulative, right? So it's not, you know, it's not simply sort of moving step by step, but it's actually growing by matters of degree. So in 2012, Jill Stein got three times the number of votes that the Green Party nominee had gotten in 2008. This time around, she got three times what she had gotten the previous time. So that's definitely moving in the right direction in terms of party growth. But it is a cumulative process. It's not automatic. You don't simply move from nowhere to winning the White House, even if that was really your goal. I think for most Greens, we see a new constitution and a genuine political revolution as being a primary goal even ahead of that. The answer is that out of the process of struggle, out of the process of movement building, out of the process of campaigning both for votes and also on particular issues, on particular fronts, people gain experience. New folks join the political party, in this case, the Green Party, and they become part of building the larger movement. That's how we grow. So I think, you know, we're moving in the right direction right now.
Yeah, no, well, I think that's a very good point. And I think certainly there's really no doubt for anyone who's paying anything like even remotely close attention to what's happening in the country. If they think that there's not a powerful movement on the left, then they certainly aren't paying attention. But I just want to thank you, Ben, for coming on the show. Again, that was Ben Mansi. He's an advocate, a scholar, a lawyer, and a public speaker. And as you know, someone who is very involved with giving us some alternatives at the ballot box on the progressive side of things. We are going to take a break, but we're coming back with more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. And as always, I am your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're talking a little bit about Donald Trump's selection of Ben Carson as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and more importantly, what is potentially at least in store and what some of the challenges and problems are for different affordable housing initiatives in the United States as we move forward. And we are very happy to be joined for this conversation by Michael Caine, who's the Executive Director of the National Alliance of HUD Tenants, and Ed Lucas, who's the President of the National Alliance of HUD Tenants. And for those who may not know, who are listening, the National Alliance, which was founded in 1991, is the first national membership organization of resident groups advocating for 2.1 million lower-income families in privately owned HUD-assisted multifamily housing. And I have to say, I've been at some of their rallies, and they have a lot of power that goes along with their organizing. And thank you both so much for joining the show.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Of course. So, Michael, I'll start with you here. I mean, I know that it's difficult. There's not that much to say in terms of, what we know about Ben Carson and housing. We only know a little bit. But what are some of your initial qualifications? And I was hoping you could also speak to the fact that I think for a lot of people, they don't even view HUD as a powerful agency. So maybe also just a little bit about whoever's in the position, what kind of power they have.
Well, you know, we were concerned when Carson was nominated because he has no background in housing at all. And in fact, it said just a couple of weeks ago, they didn't have the experience to direct any federal agency. So that was a concern. The only thing we know about his positions on housing is that he came out publicly against fair housing, anti-discrimination provisions and regulations. So the recent regulations adopted by HUD are likely to be rescinded, and that'll be a setback for efforts to fight gentrification and discrimination in government-assisted housing. So that's a concern. Beyond that, we don't know much about what he's going to do or say about housing. That may reflect the new administration's attitude toward housing, that it's just not a priority for them. But that's all we really know so far about that appointment.
Mm-hmm. And Ed, I'm curious if you have any initial thoughts about this. I mean, obviously, either way, if there is major urban policy from the Trump administration, a lot of it is going to run through HUD. And so certainly it's a pivotal role, even though I think a lot of people don't know it. But any initial off the top things you thought when you saw that this had come out as the potential pick?
Yeah, like Michael just said, number one, he has no background at all in housing. So I'm not sure, you know, I wish I could do that. I wish I could walk up and say, hey, I want this job, let me have it.
Right.
And somebody took me seriously and gave it to me. You know, so our major concern is just that he doesn't have any type of housing expertise at all. So that's the first thing. The second thing is also, HUD is an extremely powerful agency. I mean, they house a great number of individuals who need housing. So, you know, I don't know why people may think that it's not a powerful agency. It is. It HUD houses a great many people. So it's going to be interesting just to see what policies come forward out of this, number one. And then number two, what's going to happen to some of the things that we've fought so hard to make sure take place to keep people in good housing. So we're just really interested to see how this is going to shake out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting. And Ed, let me stick with you for this next question, which I think is related to what you said there at the end, which is kind of the state of grassroots organizing. I mean, I think sort of as every Trump appointee is put out there, there's a lot of, fear and despair and different things popping up there. But, you know, from my own perspective, I live in Washington, D.C., and, you know, I have the opportunity to travel a lot around the country. I mean, there does seem to be sort of a growing grassroots movement around issues of affordable housing, public housing, making sure that, we're tightening up many of the rules and regulations to make it possible for people to have a home over their head. So, I mean, it's not all sort of doom and gloom. It's not as if Trump and whoever he appoints, whether it be Ben Carson or whoever makes it through the nomination, has control of the whole situation. But in fact, there's grassroots movements that are also making an impact.
I mean, and that's absolutely correct. You know, I've been involved with NAT for about the past 4 or 5 years. Michael's been around for well over 20, 30 years. And so, you know, we're going to do all that we can to make sure that people are aware of what situations come down the pipe in terms of legislation and any other situations that may develop that will affect people's tenancy in housing. So we'll just need to see how this is all going to shake out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Michael, let me ask you this, because one issue, and for me, it's always been a huge issue, and I don't know how this is potentially already shaking out or how it may shake out sort of policy-wise, if there's been any discussion about this yet. But, you know, with so many states now starting to legalize marijuana, are we going to see, should we see sort of a changed orientation you know, terms of HUD, whether it be public housing or whatever, around people's convictions potentially for certain drug crimes? Is there any fear that there could be more barriers put in front of people getting vouchers or being put in public housing around things? I mean, it seems like that's an area where there's kind of a disconnect between housing policy and some of what's happening in America on drug policy.
Well, just on that issue, the current HUD secretary, Julian Castro, actually came out with some pretty progressive administrative orders in the last year that would make it a little bit easier for ex-offenders to find housing, for example, and the fair housing rules that were pretty strong. And another one that was important to our membership around harassment and bullying and senior and handicapped housing, which is an epidemic. The new administration has been saying they're going to look at all executive orders and regulations issued by the last one. So we're going to be watching it very closely to make sure there's not steps backward around those issues. Although the fair housing rule is probably pretty dead, I have to say, because they've been pretty open about that. The bigger concern is more around the funding levels, whether HUD rental housing funding is going to be continued and whether time limits and work requirements are going to be imposed as a condition of housing assistance. Those issues have been raised on Capitol Hill by Paul Ryan in his anti-poverty plan. And there's now no barrier to adoption of the Ryan budget and all the draconian cuts that go with it, not just to housing, but to education, job training, transportation, all domestic programs that are funded out of the congressional discretionary budget, but also the entitlement programs. They've said very clearly they're going to block grant Medicaid with deep cuts, and that's going to hurt a lot of poor people in housing and elsewhere, cutting them off of medical assistance. They're going to voucherize Medicare for elderly and handicapped people. About half of the people in HUD housing are elderly and handicapped, and Social Security is on the chopping block. So, and food stamps. So all of that is going to be threatened with deep cuts very soon. And there's no barrier now to adoption of those cuts. So that's going to have the biggest effect, I think, on the 5 million tenants, not just HUD multifamily, but public housing and voucher tenants.
Mm.
Voucher tenants are probably the most vulnerable.
Wow.
Because they don't have the ownership industry and the banking industry behind their subsidies. They have only housing authorities, which are a politically weak constituency in Washington. So there's a real danger that the number of people receiving Section 8 vouchers might be cut. And remember that only 1 in 5 low-income people who qualify for subsidies are able to get them. It's not an entitlement. The biggest subsidies are to upper-income home owners and property owners. That's where most of the housing subsidies in America actually go, through the mortgage interest deduction. We'll see what happens to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's a good point that you raised, too, because, and you mentioned the issue of work requirements as well. And I wonder if there's really sort of a connection between the two things, the budget cuts and the work requirements. I mean, I think anyone who knows anything about employment in this country knows, especially if you're low income and black and interested, getting a job, no matter where you live, is extraordinarily difficult. So, I mean, to all of a sudden tie people's housing to work requirements just seems totally fanciful to me in terms of it making any real difference in people getting employed. But it certainly, especially if it's hard to employ communities, is an easy way to cut the people who are eligible or stop people from remaining eligible due to their employment situation.
Yeah, no, that's right. Ryan's poverty plan talked about work requirements and time limits for both housing assistance, but also food stamps. And, you know, it's virtually a kind of slavery in a way to require people to work in exchange for just living when there's no real jobs out there. You know, they're probably going to force people to volunteer in some kind of way without payment in order to, you know, stay in their home.
Mm-hmm.
If they're able to, presumably, but that there will be a lot of gray area things around that. I mean, are they going to make elderly people and handicapped people go out and try to find a job in order to receive assistance?
Mm.
A lot of those issues will come up. So we don't know. We have no idea where Carson stands on those things. I think that will be important for the Senate to explore in his confirmation hearing. I hope they ask him about that.
Well, and I hope you do too. Ed, let me ask you this question, because, you know, one of the biggest issues to me about whether it's someone with a Section 8 voucher, someone in a multifamily unit, was someone in, you know, quote unquote, traditional public housing, anyone who's getting any sort of housing subsidy, I feel like the only way I ever see it portrayed in the media is as in some negative way. You know, like either there's a public housing unit that's falling down, or these people who are doing this kind of thing. And I've always felt that so many of these conversations around how do we fund affordable housing of all sorts of different types gets caught up in these stereotypes about who is getting housing assistance. But I'm always shocked, whether I'm in, you know, a LIHTC building, a public housing or whatever. I don't want to say shocked, but, you know, when you see it in the media, it is a little shocking that the communities are so strong and so resilient. And the negatives are, I mean, you know, like every community has negatives, but that's like kind of the least important thing about who's there, how people live together, and what's going on. But no one's ever seeing that as well, which seems like a big, big issue as context for all this. But I know you're in Chicago. You're in a HUD-assisted building. What do you think about that?
I mean, what happens is that you've got these different types of public housing ventures. So that's the first thing. There's, you know, there's public housing. You know, there's housing choice vouchers. Then there's Section 8 housing. And so the thing is that, number one, is that you've got to look at, and one of the things that we try to do as an organization is to make sure that we put out there what groups are doing around the country. There are a ton of housing organizations that are doing many, many things to make sure that, you know, people live well, that people do well. And for those, for whatever reasons, don't want to do well, that we move them around so that they don't ruin the good reputation of people who are really just trying to live. Because that's what this all comes down to. This doesn't come down to anything else but having a place to lay your head every night when the sun goes down. And, you know, 99% of the people, that's all they're trying to do. They're not out here trying to take advantage of any situations. Everybody that I've run into, and, you know, there's been one or two that maybe shouldn't be there, but, you know, the majority of people that I've run into around the country are just trying to make sure they got a place to lay their heads, just like anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so again, that's where we are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I think it's a good point. And I think it's one of those, it's always just shocking to me how somehow that gets lost in the discussion, that people just want a roof over their head as if this is some sort of, you know, insane thing that people should want. As it, I mean, it just doesn't really make any sense that somehow that becomes so demonized. And I wonder what your thoughts are about the way it breaks out. I mean, it seems to me that it's almost like a bipartisan thing. Like a lot of the stuff I might hear from Secretary Ryan, I'm often appalled by what I hear, say, in the D.C. Council about what people say, you know, like, oh, we can't just be giving people vouchers and people just want a handout and they want this. That really in the culture at large, we've just become so critical of people who are just trying to survive.
And then you've got to also remember that a lot of times they're trying to make this into a race or a class situation. And, you know, that's not true. There's many people from all different nationalities who need housing, not just black folks, not just poor folks. There's just a bunch of people who need housing. And so we need to get away from this conversation around who receives housing versus, you know, who actually needs it.
Mm.
And so that's where the conversation has to go. This isn't about, you know, any particular group or class of people getting housing. This is about people who have nowhere else to go, who has no other way to live. If they did not receive some kind of subsidy from the government that would allow them to be able to have a place to lay their head at night.
Well, and you know, Michael, let me ask you this. I mean, is there a contradiction between a lot of what I hear from housing authorities around the country with the idea of sort of breaking down concentrated poverty and the idea of giving everyone a home? I mean, I think the way sort of it's always presented in the front end is there's no contradiction at all. But I often find sort of an interesting coincidence that as soon as all of a sudden some private building or some public housing or whatever it may be has a redevelopment plan in place, all of a sudden the maintenance starts falling down and, you know, different interesting things start happening, making it more difficult to live there. And I mean, it almost seems as if like a lot of the conversation we get about development, redevelopment, or whatever, however it's framed, sort of one of the main goals is to disperse large numbers of people who aren't, you know, quote unquote, market rate tenants paying $1 million per month or whatever it is.
You got to understand too that this now, when you ask that particular type of question, now we're moving away from people needing housing to people wanting to do redevelopment to make money. And so that's what it boils down to at the end of the day when you ask those type of questions. This isn't about anything else but people wanting to build housing that's going to make them money.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
And there are enormous development pressures building in most of the major cities, especially along the coasts and in everywhere in between where there's gentrification and higher income people wanting to move into the cities. And the development interests want to rebuild the cities in a different vision of class and racial segregation. And that is happening with extreme rapidity.
Everywhere there is. Well, we're going to have to put a pin in it there. I apologize, gentlemen. We're out of time for today. But that was Michael Caine and Ed Lucas from the National Alliance of HUD Tenants. Google them, search them, get involved, help them out. They do great work all around the country. And with that, we are out of time for today's show. You are listening, as always, to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Pergier. See you next time.
By any means necessary.